I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long way to go.
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the March 2012 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, we have a stellar show for you, packed to the brim with retro gaming goodness. First off, we have tons and tons of bits and bytes to cover. New editorial commentary on why killing off used games is not good for retro gamers. We're also going to look at reviews of Choplifter HD for popular consoles and the computer, as well as Another World, the new release of Out of This World for the Android and the iOS platform. And finally, we're also going to be looking at MAME for Droid Reloaded, a brand new MAME emulator. For a change, a mobile device gets an upgraded version of MAME. We're going to tell you all about it. So stick around. I've been posting information with regards to the Retro Gaming Radio Year 8 DVD. Now, about 20 of you have pre-ordered this DVD many, many years ago, and I've, over the years, have mentioned the reasons why the Year 8 disc has been such a pain in the tail end to do. I recently found a solution, and so I posted up on Monroe World Forums, as well as on Google+. What solution I had to come up with and why this thing has taken so long. So I figured I'd go ahead and address it on the air. Those of you who are Year 8 pre-orderers, you will receive the product still as promised, along with a little something extra for the wait. But let me tell you really what's going on with the Year 8 disc and why it became such a problem. In the early days, way back when, I used a product called Scala. I'm not sure how you actually pronounce that. I've always pronounced it Scala, but I bet it's pronounced the other way. I believe it's a Canadian product, so you got to talk like this and say Scala. I'm going to call it Scala, even though it's probably wrong. Anyway, Scala for the Amiga was this great video titling package, right? It was used to make these insane video presentations that were designed to be put on film or to be broadcast on television. The results of the product were absolutely fantastic. Well, once I got into the PC around 1995-ish, I realized that there was a version out for the PC, and while it was still sort of in its infancy compared to the Amiga version, it was still remarkably decent. Well, being a previous Amiga owner of the product, I was entitled to a single upgrade to the PC version, but I was not eligible for any other upgrades beyond that point. Back then, of course, you're talking about Windows 98, Windows 95, and of course, eventually XP. Well, the product worked very well on Windows 95 and 98, and I was able to put together the first series of Retro Gaming Radio DVDs. Unfortunately, about the time I got to Year 8, everybody had started, you know, moving up. And Windows Vista, of course, XP, and now 7, the product just wasn't really designed to run in those environments. In fact, under XP, I was experiencing constant crashes. Essentially, I'd build a slide, and if I didn't save it fast enough, it would crash. You know, this was the sort of development hell that I was in, trying to put the Year 8 together. Now, back then, of course, there also wasn't a very good option for virtual PCs. You know, right now, I had somebody write to me recently after posting the comment, said, well, why don't you just run XP in a VM? It's like, yeah, I could do that at this point. But at the same time, now I'm producing a product that was really designed to run under, you know, XP at best. You know, what's going to happen if I put this out in the wild with Windows 7 64-bit and blah, blah, blah. So what I really needed to do was find a replacement for Scala that was usable, right? That was something that could replace the product and still give me the desired interface that I want, because I love the smooth organic transitions and all of the things that Scala allowed me to do. And so a couple years back, actually it was about a year and a half ago back, I dug up a product actually designed to make, oddly enough, designed to make auto-run programs for CDs and DVD presentations. And it was very feature-rich. I thought, you know, it's going to let me do the sort of things that I want to do. And so I waited for a sale. It was like $80. And I jumped on it. And I figured, okay, well, I'll be able to throw this thing together. Well, I started working with it, and I kept finding problem after problem after problem with it. And I would write the developer, and they'd give me some goofy-ass workaround, and so I would do that. And then I'd be back online for a little while until I reinstalled my computer, right? Or if I had to refresh my computer, I'd have the same problems again. So basically every 6 months or so, I go out and I look to see if there's a product that can duplicate what Scala did so that I can get this Year 8 DVD out. And, of course, produce a Year 9 DVD and probably whatever else. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the future of the classic RGR property later. So anyway, so recently I discovered something called Opus Creator. I know what's with me and think products named Opus, right? But this product actually does exactly what I need, and I have already begun rebuilding the Year 8 DVD with that product, and it's moving along very well. And if you'd like more details, check out the Google Plus account, check out Monroe World Forums. I keep a pretty good log up there as to what's going on. But I want you guys to know it was not, I have not forgotten about you, and everyone's going to get their product. It's going to take forever, but you're going to get the product, and it's going to be what I had intended it to be, which is, you know, similar to the 7 and the Year 5 and 6 DVD products. So it's still on the way, and the future's looking so bright, I have to wear shades. Right. Speaking of classic RGR, I've had a lot of people throw input my way that they want the entire collection. They want every episode of Classic Retro Gaming Radio before we went off the air. They want the whole package. Every single Retro Gaming Radio show from day one to the end of the original broadcast. Right now, Year 8 and technically Year 9, it's been a 10-year, it was a 10-year stretch that we ran, but we had some downtime in between, especially when Brian Kitthive Smith passed away. So we really have like 9 years of shows, but it's over a 10-year period. So the concept here is, do we offer something to finish it up? Because if I remember right, there's 16 episodes that aren't in Year 8, something to that effect. So it's not quite another 2 years, so it's not a Year 9 and a Year 10, but there's definitely a Year 9. However, I'd almost be willing to scrap the Year 9 plans and say, you know what, there's not going to be a Year 9. Year 9 will be part of the definitive collection, whatever it is, the decade collection, whatever we come up with, you know, myself and the fans, Alex, whatever we come up with, you know, the decade collection, every single episode. Now, obviously, we've got all of these great discs are already out there, right? We've got the Retro Gaming Radio yearly DVD-ROMs. They're packed full of extras, tons and tons of stuff you don't get outside the show. But other people just want the shows. Well, they don't care about the extras. They don't care about the uncut interviews. They don't care about all the behind-the-scenes videos, the blooper reels, and all that other stuff that we put together. Not interested in that. They just want the shows. And I understand that concept. I get it. So the question is, how do I proceed? Do I put together this ultimate disc pack that has every single DVD title, every single episode along with that, and put it in this big fat box and charge a commensurate rate for that? Or do I put together a 10-year collection on, you know, 4 or 5 CDs, you know, that you could actually put in your car, MP3 player, or it could fit on a single disc, you know, fit single DVD. But, you wouldn't be able to just stick that in the car and go with it. You'd have to copy it to some other medium. How do I proceed with that? What's a fair price for either one of those products? Every single disc set, along with all the recent shows that didn't get aired, or, I'm sorry, that were not released on a disc, and, a starving student edition. What's a fair price? What's a fair package for that sort of thing? I need you guys' help. You're the ones that are going to be buying this stuff, right? So I need to know what you guys are looking for in a package. What do you want? Do you want all the bells and whistles? Do you want shows only? Do you want them a la carte? Do you want me to actually, you know, just stick them online somewhere like an iTunes and charge a buck a hit for the shows? I don't know what you guys want. I don't know what you want. So why don't you guys give me some feedback? Let me know what you guys think. And we'll go from there, deciding on how to finish off the remainder of the classic RGR. We did have a live show recently, a live interaction on Google Plus Hangouts. It's a relatively new experience, and a lot of people, it took us a long time to actually get into a groove where we were talking about retro gaming. It was a good time, though. We had a lot of people show up. We had a great representation. One guy even called up on his iPhone. He was on his iPhone on his way to the airport or something like that, and he got in on the Google Hangout right from his phone while his wife was driving. Very, very cool stuff. And if you keep an eye on our news feeds, that is the Twitter, Google Plus, and the website as well as the forums, whew, that's a mouthful. If you keep an eye on those locations, we're going to actually post the video from the live event as well as an MP3 file that you can take with you and you can listen to what all went down during the live event. It was really interesting. We'll be doing more of them. A lot of people needed to get their cameras working and get the Google Plus plugins working in their browser and all that stuff. So the first time through is always going to have some growing pains, but the next time it'll be a lot more fun. Speaking of which, all the different ways to get a hold of us, it's probably worthwhile during this introduction period to give you guys an idea where we're at, how to get to us, how to send us responses, and send us your ideas. First off, the website is kind of the hub, right? If you go to the website, which is retrogamingradio.com, you will find access to all of the different social media networks that we're part of, how to get on the Twitter, how to get to the Google+, how to get to our forums. All of that stuff is right there on the website. But we do have a Twitter feed. We do have a Google+ page, as well as I also have a personal circle on Google+. And we have a dedicated Twitter account, which is Retro Gaming Radio minus the O. So it's Retro Gaming Radio, no O. And the no O is because Twitter doesn't let you have a long enough username. So Retro Gaming Radio, Yeah, that's what you got for that. And, of course, the forums are at www.monroeworld.com. That encompasses my other podcast, Passenger Seat Radio, as well as some of my other endeavors, as well as Retro Gaming Radio. So that's how you can get a hold of us. Of course, bits and bytes at retrogamingradio.com is the email you send your news submissions to. And that's about it. We also have a Shoutcast. A lot of people don't know about the Shoutcast. Go to shoutcast.com, fire up your favorite Shoutcast player, and search for Retro Gaming Radio. You'll find Retro Gaming Radio Plus, which is our 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week classic Retro Gaming Radio shows all the time, 24/7. We had the Don Bluth interview on, I think, yesterday during the workday. So very, very cool stuff to go catch up on those episodes maybe you hadn't purchased or you just totally forgot about. It's really neat. And you can thank Alex J. Lopez, the producer, for running that and keeping that fresh with content and rotation for you. So that's pretty much it for the introduction phase of the show. We've got tons more stuff to talk about, along with our next up will be our new editorial commentary. First off, we didn't get any reader mail per se this month. Nothing that I would feel, you know, comfortable of pulling it out, saying this was an exceptional email and reading it on the air. But we did get plenty of small blurbs, bits of posts and tweets and everything congratulating us on the new show. We love the new show format. Thanks for bringing it back, that sort of thing. So we're very appreciative for any of the feedback that we get on the show, both good and bad. So we appreciate everyone who sent in a little blurb. And if we get a particularly interesting piece of reader email, of course, we'll read it here on the air. This month's editorial commentary deals with the concept of squelching, or preventing the sales, resales, trading, and loaning of used games. Now, this is a big, there's a huge movement behind this, right? There's a lot of people who are pissed off at the used game market. This, of course, mainly being GameStop, but there's plenty of other entities that buy, sell, and trade used games. There are mom-and-pop shops that do it. Of course, Play and Trade's another large chain that does the same thing, but GameStop's the biggest, and they tend to have the rifle aimed at them more of the time than anybody else. Now, as you may or may not have guessed, the biggest proponent of squelching used games are publishers, right? They've got a fantasy built up in their mind that used game sales are detrimental to their bottom line, to their profit margin. And just to give you an idea is what I'm talking about. For those of you who may be very, very much isolated in the retro gaming field and aren't playing modern consoles or playing modern gaming, it works like this. Essentially, let's say Activision puts out a new Call of Duty game, right? Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3. So they put this game out. They sell it for $59.99. That's the retail new price. And believe me, that's what you're going to pay no matter where you go. It's very price fixed. Everywhere you go, it's the same price, including GameStop. So you purchase the game at GameStop for $59.99, $60. You take it home, you play it, you beat the solo mission, you play online for a couple of weeks, and you're bored of the game. A lot of people are that way. I know. I don't think of games in a disposable medium either, but a lot of people do. So they say, okay, well, I'm done playing the game. I'm going to take it back to GameStop, and I'm going to trade it in, trade it up, right? So you take the game back to GameStop, and depending on how old the game is, how popular the game is, depending on the demand for the game, GameStop will give you X number of dollars for the game. And usually it's somewhere in the vein of 50% trade-in, if it's a good game, right? Right now, if you were to go buy Modern Warfare 3 at GameStop, the game is still $59.99. But they will give you, at this point in time, like $24.50, something like that, if you go and trade the game in right now. So it's definitely in GameStop's favor to pay you $25 for this game. And what they then turn and do is take the game, put it back on the shelf as a previously used or used title, and they charge $5 less than the retail price, which is $54.99. Right? So GameStop makes a huge amount of money doing these sort of trades. Well, the publishers look at this as, well, wait a minute. What guy's going to go in there and not get the same game for $54 that they could get for $59? Why would they pay the extra $5? You know, if you have a discount card at GameStop, you save 10%, that's another $5 off, so now you're talking about $49.99. Publishers are relatively sure that somebody's going to go in and see the game on the shelf, and there's one that's $59, there's one that's $49, they're going to walk off with the $49 game, which then in turn does not lead to a new game sales for Activision selling the game. So the publishers look at this as a huge issue. It's a huge problem. They figure they should be seeing that the return on that used game sale. So some companies like Electronic Arts and others have adopted a new model where if you want to play online, you have to use a one-time use code that comes in the box. So you buy Mortal Kombat for $60, you take it home, you enter the code so you can play online. You bring it back to the store, they give you $25 for it, they turn around and put it back on the shelf for $55, $55.99, but you can't play that game online anymore. Not unless you pay the developers an extra $10 to play online. Which means it goes back to the point where you're now being punished because you decided to buy the game used versus new. The publishers look at it as like, well, we're recouping our money, right? And this whole process is very draconian and very very evil, if you ask me. And I'll explain to you why. And then I'm going to get to the fact of how this affects retro gamers and classic gamers. But this is a big deal because a lot of classic gamers and retro gamers are modern game players too. So we need to look at this thing from all angles. The bottom line is the amount of money that they make on a sale. Let's say that GameStop sells a game for $60, right? Everybody along the way gets a cut of that money. GameStop gets a cut of the money. If it was sold at Walmart, Walmart gets a cut of the money. The publishers get a cut of the money. Then the developers get a cut of the money unless they're being fully funded. There's a whole bunch of different ways that the money gets distributed. But in the end, right, it costs a certain amount of money to make the game, so there's a cost overhead. Let's say it costs $5 to put a DVD in a box and put it on a truck and ship it to its final destination. That cost is immediately eaten by whoever's going to get the biggest chunk of the profit, right? The publishers, the developer, publisher house. So they have to eat the initial $5, right? They take a cut of the money after the sale. A lot of times, what a lot of people don't know is some of these companies ask to be paid in advance. Some of the companies won't even, some of these companies will make you buy the copies in advance, and then you have to essentially sell back the copies you don't sell back to the publisher. There's all sorts of interesting little pricing scams going on with the distribution of software. A little outside the scope of this discussion, but I want you to know there's a lot of little evils and injustices going on behind the scenes. But let's stick with the frontline stuff, all right? So they're netting an extra $10 off the top of every one of these used game sales if you want to play online. Right? Now that's $10 free and clear. okay, they have to pay a credit card processor, you know, 2.6% or whatever it is, probably less because they're EA, they're Activision, right? So they're really netting an $8 profit immediately on the top of that used game. They're taking that $8, which probably isn't above and beyond very much less than what they would have taken off the original product. I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I'm sure it varies from game to game. My point is, that's money that the publisher doesn't share with anybody, that they take straight from you into their pocket, right? That's $10. That's a lot, especially if you just save $5 buying the game used, which, of course, is their exact idea. If we make it unpleasant for you to buy used games, you'll buy the new games, so you don't have to pay the $10 surcharge on top. Well, that only works for multiplayer games that are online, right? There's plenty of games out there that offer plenty of delightful playtime that does not have an online component that they can regulate and stop you from using by buying a used game. So there's still a deal to be had out there for people who are shopping for used games. Now, here's the important part of the whole scenario. As a game player, as a game buyer, this is the part that's important to me. As we all know, gaming is a crapshoot these days. For every fantastic game, for every Mortal Kombat reinvention, for every fantastic title that's out there, there's at least 50 titles that are complete crap, right? And when you're talking about $60 a hit, you'd like to have a little something that backs the guarantees that there's going to be some return on this investment. If you buy Modern Warfare 3 for $60 and it turns out you don't like it, you have to take it back to GameStop and they'll give you $25 for it, right? If you could try to sell it on Craigslist or eBay, but then you're talking your time, your gas, your level of effort to turn around and resell that product, which for a lot of people is not worth the time. Right, if it takes you an hour of negotiation on the phone, driving to somebody's house, meeting somebody halfway, shipping, packing, going to the post office, shipping the product out, if you look at all of these things, people are saying, well, $25 doesn't sound that bad, and they'll take it back to GameStop for the $25, right? Instead of wasting all that free time listing the game, trying to sell the game, and making an extra, you know, $20 on top of it, they'll just say, screw it, we'll take it back to GameStop. It's right on the way to work. They'll give me cash. They'll give me a little extra credit. And I can actually go buy a game I do like. So that's how it works with a new game. Part of the used game philosophy that people don't seem to realize is the concept of try before you buy. New games don't offer you that option unless you're willing to take a 60% hit on the return of your money. A lot of people condemn GameStop without understanding that GameStop's used gaming system and sales system is very, very slanted toward the end user, towards the consumer. If I go and buy Modern Warfare 3 for $54.99, okay, let's even say $49.99 because I have a player's choice card or whatever the hell it is they call it, power rewards, whatever, because I have that card, I get it for $49.99. All right, great. So now I take the game home, and I still don't like it. I don't like it, right? So I take it back. I get $49.99 and my sales tax back put back onto my card or in my hand as cash, right? It is there's 7 days, 7 days of that policy, right? 7 days, I can buy any used game in the place, take it home, play it for 7 days, and return it with no restocking fees, nothing. There's no reason not to do that, right? When you're talking about $60 or $59, $55, $49, you're talking about wanting to have the experience of taking that game home and trying it out. There's probably not a demo for it for you to try. Nobody's making magazines with cover discs anymore for you to try demos on there. So how do you know you're going to like the game or not? Watching cutscenes videos off of YouTube? No. You need to play the game. Used gaming gives you that option at GameStop. That's a huge service. People don't look at it that way, but that's a huge service. I call it the GameStop rental system. In reality, how many games do you need more than 7 days to play anymore, right? Can you finish Mass Effect in less than 7 days? You bet. Can you play all through Skyrim in 7 days? That might be tough. But there's a plethora of games out there that you can play through in less than 7 days, return it, and get all of your money back. That's not even a rental. That's a I don't even know what you'd call that. That's charity work right there. That's like checking something out of the library. You bring it back and you don't owe any money. That's what people want to see. People want to see GameStop go away because of the 60%, you know, markdown with the 90% mark back up. I get that. I understand that that's a horrible business practice. However, you also have to look at it from the positive side. The GameStop is providing an invaluable service to the game players, giving us these essentially free game rentals. It's hard to argue with that. So tons of people are calling for the heads of GameStop. People are saying, let us have digital distribution. That's fair. That's what we want. We want digital. We don't even want to go to GameStop. Screw GameStop. Screw Walmart. We don't want to go anywhere. Just deliver us the games local. Now, there's a problem, of course, with digital distribution. First of all, the publishers love it, right? They maintain complete control. When you buy that game, you download it to your hard drive on your Xbox, they own it. You don't own anything. You own the right to play it. You have no aftermarket recourse with that product. None. In fact, here's the best part. Even if you sell the Xbox to somebody else, the game's tied to your account. So unless you're willing to sell your Xbox Live ID along with your Xbox, you have no aftermarket. That game has zero value the moment that you purchase it. None. At least at GameStop, you can get $25 back from it if you buy it new. And it'd be different if these companies were charging less than retail, right? If I'm going to pay $59 for a game that's on GameStop shelves, they have employees to pay, rent to pay, the game had to be shipped, there was a box that was made, I got a disc, I got a box, I got the pack-in stuff, I got a felt map, whatever. You know, there's cost involved in that. You're selling me essentially, you know, a 2 gigabyte download is what you just sold me. And you're charging the same price. So digital distribution is great for publishers. They make more money. They don't have to let GameStop have a piece of the action. They don't have to pay UPS to take the game to the retailer shelves. They love it. They make so much more money on that model than they do selling the game at the store. How does it benefit you, the end user? You can say, well, I don't have to go buy it at GameStop. Okay, you don't have to go buy it. But now what do you do with it when you're done with it? You erase it? You can't sell it on eBay. You can't sell it on Craigslist. Chances are likely that in 20 years, you're not even going to be able to boot up to connect to that server somewhere and authenticate you to run that game. You really have nothing. So the digital distribution solution, while it sounds tasty, especially to publishers, really end up screwing the end user in the end. You have nothing tangible. Nothing at all. And this is, my friends, is what they want to do with the next generation of consoles and with gaming in general. They want to take and make everything either brand new, where there is no methodology of trade barter, or they want to make everything digital, which is absolutely the wrong plan of attack for the end consumer. The end consumer may look at that as a bonus, but the problem is they're not getting the benefits that digital distribution should be providing them, which is lower cost. Lower cost product. They're not getting that. They're going to pay $60 for Modern Warfare 3, whether you go to GameStop and get it, whether you download it online, you're going to pay the same amount of money. So in the end, wouldn't you rather have something that has some sort of innate value after the sale is made? I know I do. We don't purchase cars or any other product with the concept of this is worth nothing to anybody after I make the purchase. Everybody buys a car thinking at some point I'm going to trade it in. At some point I'm going to resell it. At some point I'm going to be giving it to my kids, right? They're going to grow up. They're going to need a car. I'm going to have a car. They're going to be able to have it. The methodology that these companies are working towards removes all of that from you as the gamer. So how does that impact the retro gamer? How does that impact the classic gamer? What negativity does this have for those of you who are sitting around playing Robotron and firing up state-of-the-art on the Amiga? How does this affect you? Well, for many of you, it doesn't, right? But I dare say that a multitude of people in this retro gaming clique or this retro gaming circle of people, a lot of us are modern game players. So we will feel whatever the resultant is of that. But more importantly is we're actually removing a social paradigm. And this isn't a good thing. The social paradigm has existed forever with video games. Sometimes a little too social, right? That's where piracy comes from. I get a brand new game in the mail, right? This is, you know, before digital downloads, right? I buy a brand new game. I buy Legacy of the Ancients for the Commodore 64. It comes to my house. I have the disc. I can play the game on any Commodore 64, be it at my house, my dad's house when I'm on visitation. I can play it anywhere. As long as I have the disc and the code wheel, right? I can play it. I, so to speak, own it. Right? When I'm done with it, I can give it to my friend to play. Hey, listen, I just finished Legacy of the Ancients. It's fantastic. Here you go. I want you to take a turn through it. And then they get to have a turn. And they don't have to purchase it. I've already made the purchase. I've already finished it. The game no longer has value to me. I transfer the value, my interest in the game to somebody else. Right? So, bartering, loaning, trading, reselling are all social paradigms that gaming has always had part of. Going to a swap meet and finding an old, finding a 2600 cartridge you want. All of these things are part of the paradigm. This is what they want to disappear. They want all of these items to go away. Now, what does that mean? Let's say that they're successful. Let's say that GameStop is no more and there's great crying in the streets and everybody's cheering and, you know, it's huge, right? GameStop goes out of business. GameStop's gone. There is no more GameStop. Thanks to the fact that all modern games, none of them will let you resell them or buy them used. Right? So GameStop says, you know what? There's not enough money in it for us to be a full price retailer with no used game sales. We're gone. Well, GameStop doesn't just sell the latest top 10 games, right? I scope GameStop frequently for old Nintendo DS games, right? A lot of people went in there to buy GameCube games, PS2 games, right? There's a plethora of gaming that is almost considered retro that GameStop is still providing an outlet for you to find. Can you go to eBay? Sure. Can you get grifted at eBay? Absolutely. So GameStop is providing that social experience for even older gamers, right? People who are playing older games. Go and try to find some of the stuff you find at GameStop. There's a reason why they're successful above and beyond the fact that they rape you with every used game trade, right? They have a selection. They have a storefront. If you are, let me give you an example. It's easy to go to GameStop, nice, clean, it's on the corner of your grocery store. You go, it's convenient, right? You go to the store, you pick up something for dinner. Oh, and then I'm going to swing in at GameStop and see what's new, right? Something like that. Well, you remove that neighborhood gaming location, right? Now what are we back to? Now we're back to creeps selling stuff out of their garage, right? Now we're back to, you know, I'd like to get some GameCube games. But, you know, who's got a selection? Where can I go? Where do I get this stuff? You go online? Hell, you might end up getting bootlegs. You might end up getting screwed over, right? There is a convenience. Why are 7-Elevens still around? Why are Circle K's still around? Why are these convenience stores that charge $4 for a gallon of milk when it's $1.57 down at Albertsons or Safeway, why do those stores stay in business? They're raping you too, right? 7-Eleven's raking you over the coals, man. Convenience. Absolutely. And there is a value attached to convenience that GameStop provides. Now let's say that, let's take GameStop out of the equation. Let's talk about Play and Trade. Play and Trade actually has Atari Lynx games, Atari 2600 games. You could actually go to probably any Play and Trade right now and buy an Atari 2600. Right? There's probably not a huge call for that for them. That's what they call a fringe market. A fringe product that they also offer, in addition to the lucrative trading in and returning and trading and swapping of modern games, right? The new stuff. That's what the majority of gamers are into. That's where the cash cow is. If you remove that from Play and Trade's inventory, well, you can't resell a Xbox 720 game. You can't resell a PS4 game, right? There's nothing. You can't resell that digital downloaded copy of Modern Warfare 3. These companies no longer have a monetary means of making things work. So Play and Trade goes away. Now you've lost that outlet. Now we're back to what? Driving around yard sales looking for old games? You know, trying to score something on Craigslist? They should call it Psychos List, based on the sort of things that I see up there. eBay, these are horrible things, and everybody's so down on the concept of these used game stores that they're not taking into account what are the alternatives. What are the alternatives to not being able to have a GameStop at the corner? You know, GameStop is the thing you love to hate, but you still go, right? It's just like Fry's Electronics, man. I've sworn 10 times, you know, 10 ways to sundown. I'm never shopping at Fry's again, but I'm in there every single week, right? It's the store you love to hate, but you can't get rid of it either. It's like Walmart, right? You say, oh, God, I'm never going to shop. I'll shop anywhere but Walmart. Yet sometimes you have to go to Walmart. It's not a pleasant thing. But now imagine if there's the ripple effect that we're talking about here, right? This marketing ripple starts at the top. Places you don't care about, maybe GameStop, Play and Trade. That ripples down. That ripples down to the Bookmans, to the mom and pop trade stores, right? There's still a handful of them. There's a place called Fallout Games here in Phoenix. They have two locations, right? And they have everything. I mean, I don't pick a system from anywhere on the video game timeline. They have systems, they have games, they have controllers. They have that. But that ripple effect, the killing of the used game market, ripples down to these guys as well. And half of these guys are probably living on the fringe edge, you know, the fringe edge of bankruptcy anyway. They do it because they love it. You know, heaven forbid they have to actually sleep at their place and, you know, shower in the bathtub or shower in the sink because, you know, all of their money's tied up in this little mom and pop business. They do it because they love it. Well, probably the largest revenue stream that they're getting deals with this sort of gaming, this modern gaming, right? People are willing to go to a mom and pop shop if it gives them $2 more than GameStop does for that title, right? And that's great. I love it. Feed the mom and pop shops. They're going to fall into the same boat too. Then who falls next, my friends? Who falls next? Blockbuster. No, they're still around. Blockbuster falls. Redbox, right? Everyone thinks, oh, great, Redbox is running games now. Well, that's gone. They actually managed to push this through where when you buy a disc, the first time you stick it in, it writes to a small writable area of the disc and it locks it to that system. No more game rentals. That's over too. So how the hell are you going to get a game? You're going to go pay full price for it at some large retail outlet like Walmart or Target. You're going to order directly online from them and have them mail it to you. Amazon. I mean, there's going to be no local game interest, especially no place that actually makes some sort of a profit swapping and trading games. It's not a pleasant sight. It's not a pleasant rippling effect to look at. You're talking about closing down part of what makes gaming great. And that is the social interaction exchanging system that happens. It happens all the time. You know, used games actually put the possibility of games into the hands of people who normally couldn't afford it, who normally wouldn't have access to it, right? The library gives you access to books, sometimes movies and things like that for free or a very low membership. Video gaming doesn't really have that appeal, nor will it have if this sort of processes goes through. We don't want this, folks. Nobody really wants this. We all say we do. We all GameStop's name every time we take in a game and they give us 50 cents for it. We all hate that. But we all also have to realize that gaming in general has to be allowed to be a free market. It has to be allowed to be bought, sold, traded, exchanged, right? This needs to happen. By the way, this trickles down, too, to other mediums as well. Even things like thrift stores, right? Go to Goodwill. Go to, what's another one, Salvation Army. Go to some of these thrift stores. They have video games. They have DVDs. They have, I haven't seen any Blu-rays there yet, but they have aftermarket, resell, low-cost media, games, movies, all this stuff. This trickles down to them too, right? Now it's not going to close down a Goodwill if they, you know, you can't actually sell used games. And it takes a while for, you know, like you can buy 360 games at Goodwill now, but maybe a year ago you couldn't. The most you could get is an Xbox game or a PS2 game. You know, I haven't seen a Nintendo DS game in there yet. But as soon as GameStop stops taking them in trade, they'll end up at Goodwill, right? Well, what if GameStop's not there anymore, right? What if a cartridge, the second you stick it into your Nintendo 3DS, it writes something to it and it'll only work on that system forever? The usefulness of that cartridge is gone, you know? I think this is something that people need to think about long and hard, about whether or not they really, really are behind killing off GameStop, if they're really, really behind killing off used games, if they're willing to purchase a console, if they're willing to support the companies that are going to be behind stopping the legacy, the social paradigm of video game exchange, trades, reselling, loaning. We really got to look at this close, folks. And we are the people, those of us who are in retro gaming radio, or I'm sorry, in the retro gaming radio community, those of us who are in our 30s, our late 30s, early 40s, we're the ones with the money. We're the ones with the kids that give the kids the money. We have a very, we have a huge role that we can play in the preventing and reduction of this sort of behavior. We can't turn the other way saying, fine, you know what, if the Xbox 720 doesn't support used games or traded games, then screw it. I'm just not going to buy one. I'm going to go back to playing Robotron. That's fine. But remember, there's a bunch of people out there that are going to suffer because we're not willing to take up a stand and squelch this particular behavioral pattern that they're going to try to work on us. I'm serious, folks. Take a look at it. Look around. Think about it. Read some articles. See what the ripple effect might be before you're ready to condemn used gaming, before you're ready to, you know, set fire to your local GameStop. Think about the rippling and paradigms effect that this will have on gaming. And eventually it will trickle down to you. And if not you, your kids. So keep that in mind. We have an absolutely huge Bits and Bytes segment for you this month, and we're going to start that segment off with a return back to the Amiga. Interestingly enough, there's a port of Firefox, the legendary browser, web browser, has been ported to the Amiga operating system. Amazingly enough, under the name of Timberwolf, Timberwolf team is proud to announce the immediate availability of the first beta of Timberwolf 4.0.1. Timberwolf is an Amiga OS web browser based on Firefox Mozilla. Technology is more than just a browser. It's enabling technology, bringing powerful tools such as HTML5, WebM, JavaScript, XUL, and more to Amiga DOS 4.x. So this isn't going to work on your old classic Amigas, folks, but it does work on the latest Amiga OS 4. So it's kind of nice to see that such a brand name is still getting some recognition even this far along. Here's an article on The Verge. Let's see. I got to make sure I'm getting proper credit here. Yeah, this is also from me. So if it's from me or Alex, I probably won't mention who it's from. But here's an article from Ralph Baer. He's the pretty much considered the guy that created video gaming, right? There are other people that have made significant contributions, but he invented the original cartridge-based system, the Magnavox Odyssey, and he's pretty much been the man. He's turning 90, if you can believe this, right? 40 years ago, he created the Magnavox Odyssey, and this guy's responsible for tons of stuff, but it's interesting. I wanted to read you this paragraph out of here. Perhaps most surprising is Baer's apparent disappointment with the path the gaming industry has traveled since his Odyssey hit store shelves in 1972. Whereas his mission was to create a family-oriented device, Baer voices reservations with the current industry outlook, saying games have degenerated into a one-player type thing. Baer's success extends beyond the Odyssey console, which he says ultimately sold around 350,000 units. He holds over 150 patents that have led to recognizable products like the classic handheld game Simon. It's a good article. You got to understand, this guy's like 90 years old. Of course, he's going to be a little upset. But it's good. I really like The Verge, by the way. TheVerge.com is a great source of information, and I tend to read it every day. So definitely check that out. A couple of the stories I think this month come from The Verge. Let's see what's up next. Nice, some other crap for me. Ha! Up next, Sinistar takes a break. First of all, okay, it's not that funny. It's not the greatest comic in the world. However, any comic strip, I mean, there have been Pac-Man has appeared in comic strips, Mario. These are normal video game characters that you see in comic strips, or they're lampooned, or they're satirized, but you don't see Sinistar, parried in comics very often. But I'll give you a link here, of course, to the Sinistar cartoon. It's a essentially Sinistar and the player end up going out for lunch. It's funny. I mean, it's not slapstick funny, but it's entertaining enough. And again, anytime you're going to put Sinistar front and center, I'm going to be down with that. Good news for full motion video game fans like myself. The Cult Arcade FMV classic Mad Dog McCree is going to be coming to an unlikely platform, that is, the Nintendo 3DS. Classic FMV-based arcade title Mad Dog McCree will be coming to the 3DS shop soon. Let's see if there's any good details in here. The game will retain the classic FMV-based gameplay of the arcade game. It will not make use of the stereo optical visuals in the 3DS. It's all full motion video. There's really no 3DS in the 3D in the 3DS version, because how are you going to do that? Well, they could have remastered the video in 3D. It seems like everybody else on the planet's doing that. That could have been fun. But isn't the first time the game made an appearance on Nintendo platform. The original title was released as a Wii retail titled bundle with other arcade FMV shooters like Mad Dog 2, The Lost Bounty. There's a game called Fast Draw on the Wii. I think we've talked about it. If not, I'll go back and make sure if we haven't talked about it yet. It's absolutely fantastic. It's a WiiWare title, so it's a downloadable. It's not even retail. I think it's like $10. And it's one of the better of the full motion video type shootout games. We'll talk about that on a future show. But I'm very excited to see that Mad Dog is going to be coming to my favorite handheld. Let's see. And, okay, Yeti sent in Inside Atari. This is a book. Let's see if I can give you something very specific about it. Let's see. There's a lot of, let's see, what to expect. Here we go. I've already had some questions as to the content of Inside Atari. The book will mostly focus on the arcade business with some consumer, product content, such as the 2600. The majority of the content has never been seen outside of Atari. They're planning 8 chapters, which include pictures of, the 70s and 80s from Atari, 1970s concept drawings, paintings, and photos, 80s concept drawings, paintings, and photos, the Atari Industrial Design Group, consumer-related photos of the assembly line. There's all sorts of good stuff, and they've got a couple of samples posted. So this is pretty neat. I like seeing some coverage of classic stuff. And unfortunately, this is going to be an Apple iBooks publication. That's going to keep me from ever seeing it. But hopefully it'll work itself out to some other more cross-browser, cross-platform. So even if it's a digital PDF or something like that, would be great. So it's too bad it's going to be on iBooks. I'll never see it. But those of you with the iDevices, be checking this out and see what Inside Atari is all about. Thank you, Yeti, for that piece of information. Several people sent me in a link to this PCMag.com article, 10 Classic Computer RPGs. Now, first of all, RPGs, especially classic RPGs, have a near and dear place in my heart, and when you start talking about lists, especially classic lists, and they're done usually by somebody who doesn't know anything about them, it usually ends up pissing me off. But this list I thought was rather interesting. I'm going to share these with you. Of course, you can read the whole article. But I'm going to give you the list in order. I'm assuming we're going 10 to 1 here. It doesn't say the top 10. It just says 10 classic computer RPGs. So the one they mentioned first off is an Apple II title, Might and Magic 2 Gates to Another World. That's 1988. And I never played that one, so I can't really comment on it. The next one on the list is Exodus Ultima 3. That's a 1983. Also on the Apple II, which I find interesting, I do believe that one was ported a couple of more times, but that was the original platform that it was on. And GOG.com, G-O-G.com, actually has it as part of a three-pack that you can purchase. Here's a title that I never expected to ever make one of these lists, and I'm totally thrilled that it did. The title is The Fairy Tale Adventure, Book 1 from 1987, published by Micro Illusions, and it came out on the Amiga. It was one of the very, the first titles, but one of the early titles on the Amiga. And The Fairy Tale Adventure, it's a gorgeous game. It's huge. It's deep. It's an amazing title, and it's available, I believe, you can get that from Abandonware sites, because Micro Illusions, of course, is no more. But it's an amazing game, especially for, you know, its age, and I don't know. I always thought that it was interesting that the Fairy Tale Adventure never got any real good kudos. But it's an amazing little game. It's worth taking a look at, especially if you're into classic RPGs. Next up, Tales of the Unknown, Volume 1, The Bard's Tale. Of course, Bard's Tale is going to be on the list, right? Also originating on the Apple II. See, all these are 8-bit games, right? They all started on the 8-bit, except for, of course, Fairy Tale. Bard's Tale is a huge one. Everybody's played Bard's Tale. I ended up liking other games more than Bard's Tale, but I definitely spent my time on Bard's Tale as well. Next up is Rogue. Of course, Rogue is the ASCII-based dungeon crawler that ended up starting up on mainframes in the early 80s and then found its way onto home computer platforms. And the concept, of course, has been expanded upon and redone and remade a million different ways and a million different times. But it was totally randomly generated. Everything was random, so there's really no reason to ever stop playing it. So, of course, there was NetHack and a couple of other different ones out there that kind of mimicked this. And one of my favorites, which was very similar to it but more action-oriented, was Gateway to Abshai, which you've heard me talk about before. Let's see. Next up on the list, Starflight. Started on the IBM PC. I'm not sure. I guess that's technically a role-playing game. You know, you typically think of fantasy role-playing, but not this one. I never played that one, and so I can't comment on that one in particular. Next up is the excellent Dungeon Master. I don't know what just happened to my voice there. Dungeon Master, of course, a lot of people believe it was an Amiga title first, including myself. Unfortunately, it was not. It was the Atari ST. It was ported pretty close at the same time, so it's easy to misunderstand where it came from. But Dungeon Master was one of the most remarkable games. It was a lot like Bard's Tale, only on steroids, with amazing graphics, incredible stereo sound. It's another one of those Abandonware titles. And if you've never played Dungeon Master, make sure you're playing it on the ST or on the Amiga emulators, because I don't think it'd be nearly as fun on a console. Next on the list, Pool of Radiance. This, of course, was the beginning of what they called the Gold Box Adventures. All of these were AD&D type rules. This is like the first time that Advanced Dungeons & Dragons was licensed into a computer game. It was huge. All the things that you've seen in Dungeons & Dragons appeared in here. The same monsters, the statistics. For the AD&D purists, this was the first time you actually got to play it on a computer. So that makes it a very worthy addition to this. Fantasy. Yeah, this was kind of cool. I remember playing Fantasy. This, of course, started on the Apple II as well. And there's a ton of different ports of it, and there were I think there was like 4 or 5 sequels, something crazy like that. But Fantasy was one of those turn-based type adventure games, right? You walk around, you end up in an encounter. It's a lot like what, you know, Japanese role-playing games are, right? You walk around, you get a random encounter, you kill, wash, rinse, repeat, maybe carry out some sort of a small quest. It was an interesting title as well. Spawned a lot of sequels. Wizardry Proving Grounds of the Mad Overlord, 1981. This is another Apple II. You notice most of these started on the Apple II. I don't think I played the very first Wizardry. I came in a little bit later. Maybe it was 2 or 3. Something like that. Yeah. But yeah, Wizardry's definitely belonging of, on this list as well. So there you go. There's the top 10 list, and it's not a bad top 10 list either. Again, various people sent that in, so I don't want to single anybody out. But yeah, that was a good list. That's the sort of thing I like to talk about here on the show. That's a perfect topic. Next up, Greg Howlett sent in a link to something called FreeDOS. Now, I'm assuming this is another MS-DOS type replacement. There's not a whole lot of information here immediately available. There's a wiki that you can get some information out of. Essentially, it is a DOS-compatible deal, allows you to do multi-boot. It supports FAT32 file systems. So it's essentially DOS on steroids. Let me give you what they say here on the wiki. The goal of the FreeDOS project is to create another implementation of MS-DOS. DOS is a popular operating system, and there's plenty of PC hardware already available that is ready to support it. Microsoft will not develop DOS further, and one cannot count on third-party commercial entities to continue DOS. I feel it is then up to those on the internet to develop their own DOS, such as FreeDOS, and I feel there's a lot of support for this type of project. FreeDOS should not be targeted towards certain users. That is, the end product should be something that programmers and non-programmers may both enjoy and find useful. So if that sounds of interest to you, right, DOS is definitely falls into the realm of classic. And, of course, there are many games that do run on old PCs running on DOS. So you'll want to check that out. Next up, Gary Adamson sends in another conversion for the Amstrad CPC, Bubble Bobble. And Bubble Bobble, of course, everyone knows what Bubble Bobble is. Does it really need any interpretation? This is a remade version of Bubble Bobble for the Amstrad CPC. Unfortunately, while I originally got to review the page when I was including it in my notes, the page is not answering up right now. So it's possible that they're over their allotted bandwidth or something to that effect. Or hopefully not Taito bringing them down for having a converted game on their website. Let's hope that's not the case. We love Bubble Bobble. Bubble Bobble equal good, equal happy. All right, next up on the list, let's see here. Rob D. sent in. Here is another magazine, a digital magazine, geared towards retro gaming. It's called the Retro Games News, and it is your free retro games news magazine. Includes exclusive retro reviews of games on GBA, Game Boy, NES, Super NES, Sega Master System, Saturn, Dreamcast, PS1, Commodore 64, you name it. Exclusive interviews with industry legends, breaking news on the retro scene on the web. Get your hands on these goodies by filling out the form on the right. So give them your name and your email, and then we'll send it along. Unfortunately, I did not have an opportunity to glance over the new current issue, but it is on my list of things to do. But hopefully my passing along this URL to you and giving you access to it, hopefully you guys will get an opportunity to experience, I'm sure, what is a very great magazine. All right, let's see. What's up next here? Okay, for those of you who might have missed out, the Hanna-Barbera cartoon of Pac-Man. A lot of people remember this from the old days. Anytime I bring it up, this is 1982. Pac-Man, of course, was all the rage in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And so, of course, we're going to find a way to make more money on that. And Hanna-Barbera got the license to make a Pac-Man cartoon. And the complete first season can now be yours for just $29.99 right here on Amazon. It's a two-disc set, 13 episodes. And I remember, I'm going to be honest with you, I rather remember that it kind of sucked. Yeah. But if you have fond memories, of course, you know, one man's nostalgia is another man's nemesis, right? So feel free. If Pac-Man was your gig and you'd like to have that, then, of course, here you go. Pac-Man, the complete first season, two discs, $30. That's actually fairly pricey. That's like $2.50 an episode, something like that. Yeah. You got to really like Pac-Man. Ed Sorensen sends us in a link, The Art of Video Games. And this is from the Smithsonian American Art Museum. And this is going on from March 16th of this year to September 30th of this year. And it is a huge exhibit of the art of video games. Let me see if I can give you a, see if I can find a quick overview on what this is so I can read it to you. Let's see. Of course, oh, here we go. What is this, the celebration all about? The Art of Video Games explores the 40-year evolution of video games as an artistic medium. The exhibition highlights how new technologies have allowed for increasing interactive and sophisticated game environments while staying grounded in the traditions of each game type. It will feature games with striking visual graphics and recognize some of the creative individuals who have made significant contributions. The Art of Video Games is not about the most popular games of all time, nor is it about the individual games themselves. This is not a historic review that seeks to capture every memorable moment in video game history. So there's a whole FAQ here that will tell you all about where it is, how to get there, when it's open, etc. It is free, no tickets required, no cost, and there are five games available. This is something that's probably of importance to you. If you're thinking this is some sort of a classic gaming expo of some sort, there are only five games that are available to for visitors to play, and that is Pac-Man, Super Mario Brothers, The Secret of Monkey Island, Myst, and Flower. Each game has a time limit of a few minutes, and it may vary depending on traffic. So this is definitely an exhibit. It's not a gaming show, but I have a weird feeling that it could be extremely cool and fun to go to if you happen to be in the Washington, D.C. area where it's going to be. So thanks, Ed, for sending that one in. Interestingly enough, we have another portable Neo Geo device, the Neo Geo X. It is now considered official. And the 20th anniversary of Neo Geo is the celebration for the releasing this guy. And it doesn't say when we're going to get it, nor do we have any pricing, but it's supposed to be sometime in Q2. Let's see. I believe it's supposed to have 20 games with it, something to that effect. And, yeah, here's the list, 20 games. I'll just give you a little highlight. Art of Fighting, Baseball Stars, Fatal Fury, King of Monsters, Magician Lord, Metal Slug, Samurai Showdown, Super Sidekicks, Two Players Golf, World Heroes, and a few more, obviously, that I didn't mention. And again, no price, but I'm really kind of curious if this sort of a device really... is really what people are looking for at this point, right? I mean, why would you buy a device which is probably going to be a little on the expensive side when there are so many emulation projects and whatnot out there that can really offer some solid value, right? Maybe this project would have been better served being done for a different portable device, like, say, the Nintendo 3DS or the PS Vita, something that's already in existence, that people could have more than just limited to that 20 games. They could open things up and play stuff themselves. I don't know, but it's nice anyway to see that this the classics are still being brought forth in somewhat their original hardware. And that was provided to us by Nicola Letdocrito. Boy, I hope I didn't butcher the crap out of that name. So Nicola, thank you for Nicola, thank you so much for submitting that. Regular contributor Vince Dickinson sends in a Super Mario is surrealistic art. This, I'm not sure where I'm at with this. I'll read you the caption here. We all know who the Mario Brothers are, but have you ever stepped back and tried looking at those games from a fresh perspective, like you've never seen or heard of them before? They're bananas. There are armored turtles who stand on their hind legs and steal princesses. There's bullets with faces. We make a case for Mario's inclusion into a canon of art wider than video game. We think Mario is a piece of surrealistic artwork. And there's some interesting stuff in there. It's a fun video to watch. It's not too long. Give that a shot. Any sort of weird look at video gaming like that works for me. Thank you, Vince, for sending that one in. Jonathan Doyen is also a regular contributor. He sends us, and a couple other people sent this in too after the fact, but I already had Jonathan's name on it, so we're going to go ahead and stick with that. My favorite game, one of my favorite games of all time, Dragon's Lair. It can never seem to escape a show without being mentioned at least once. Dragon's Lair is coming to Xbox Live Arcade. Now, that doesn't surprise anybody, at least not me. However, here is what is going to happen. They are going to Fistin Kinect support. So, first of all, Dragon's Lair is an interactive movie, right? We've talked about this in the past. I won't go over this again and again. But Dragon's Lair is really an interactive movie. Not so much a video game. More as you provide the means for the story to continue, right? By making Dirk do what he's supposed to do. By tapping a direction or hitting a button. It's not exactly what you would call an arcade fest. Well, they're going to try to somehow... They're going to try to somehow make Dirk's on-screen actions somehow connectable. And in the picture they show of Dirk on the fire ropes, on the ledge, getting ready to fall off the ledge on the fire ropes, and they're trying to show you to outstretch your hand to reach for the rope. Now, in this particular case, it kind of makes sense. Kind of. But it's not going to do well for the purists, first of all. And the people who aren't purists don't tend to care about Dragon's Lair. So who is this going to end up appealing to? Now, I think it's a neat idea. It's a neat experiment. But I'm not sure exactly how well that's going to work out. But, hey, we'll take a look at it. I will borrow somebody's Kinect and try it out. Or maybe I can get the boys up at Digital Leisure to shoot me a video or something that I can get a look at this, how this works. Who knows? Maybe this will turn out to be the best way to play Dragon's Lair of all time. I probably suspect not, but hey, let's not condemn him too early, huh? Val Muno sends in, and this is something else that I think a lot of people ended up sending in later on too. This is also comes from The Verge. Commodore relaunches Amiga brand with high-end Amiga Mini. And guys, okay, listen, we've been over this a million times, all right? There is no Commodore anymore. There's no more Amiga. There's no more Commodore 64. Anything that's even remotely got the name Commodore or Amiga or 64, anything that you used to love, it's not that anymore, okay? It's just generic PC hardware slapped in a box that's got a logo on it and some faction of operating system that doesn't look at all or work at all like their original counterparts, okay? So don't be fooled. This is a lot like an Apple product, you know, except for probably not as well built. These are overpriced pieces of hardware that you're paying for the Amiga name on, and unfortunately you're ending up with something that's, I don't know, not what they say it is. So I'm always sad to see these things because, you know, there's so many ways that they could actually make this realistically impressive and make me want to buy it, but it's certainly not going to be for that. All right, next up, I have no idea who Com Trues is, but he's making music videos with DOS or ASCII-type graphics and... It's very, very, very interesting. In fact, I'm not even sure there's much I can tell you about it. Essentially, just go to the link provided and click on the YouTube video and just watch it. It's huge nostalgia. Huge nostalgia. So I would take a look at it. Like I said, I don't know who Com Trues is other than the play on names. But check it out. I think you'll be very pleased, especially if you spent any time in DOS in the old days. David Volley sends in a couple of pieces of information. First off, his Vectrex collection. There's a YouTube video for that. Essentially, he's managed to collect all but like a couple of ultra-rare Vectrex titles. And he's got his whole collection out on display. And he takes you on a little tour of it and shows you everything. And Vectrex is one of those very cultish systems. For those of you who don't know, Vectrex was a tabletop home console that was vector-based, right? Like Tempest or Star Castle. All these old vector games, Major Havoc, right? These are all vector-based games, and you didn't see a whole lot of them. You certainly didn't see them at home. They had a very distinct look and feel to them, and they never quite worked when you tried to bring them over to a raster-type environment. Well, the Vectrex is an amazing little piece of hardware. And David pulled his out of the closet, and he's going to take us on a tour. He also sent over that Retro Gamer magazine that I've written stuff for before. They are on their 100th issue. And there's tons of interesting stuff inside here. I picked up the issue myself. I haven't had a chance to read it, but it contains some great things like David Crane's Tricks of the Trade, 100 Classic Gaming Moments. There's an interview with Eugene Jarvis discussing Robotron. All sorts of good stuff, right? It's like the magazine you can't afford to miss. So you can get it electronically. You can get an electronic version, or if you're in the UK, of course, you could probably pick it up at a newsstand. Here in the US, there's still some Barnes & Nobles that do, first of all, Barnes & Nobles that still exist, and Barnes & Nobles that you can actually go down to and pick yourself up one of these guys. So that's a great issue. So make sure you pick it up and give the retro gaming or retro gamer folks a little bit of love on that. And last month I forgot to mention something called Retro Rumble. And Retro Rumble is a game show based on classic games. I'll give you their little blurb, and then you can go in and look more at what they do. Retro Rumble is where the skilled gamers of today meet the best and bizarre of classic gaming and scrap it out solely for bragging rights. You see legendary titles and total sleepers with a big dose of unrestrained commentary from the host and the players themselves. It's what used to happen in your basement every weekend, made with old school love from your friend at Arcade in a Box. So, it's actually a pretty neat little show, and I have been officially invited to come down and participate on the show. I'm not sure I would make the greatest guest, though, because I've actually played these games. So, unless they pull some really weird stuff out of the closet, which are about 10 million games that I haven't played already, that would, it might give me a little unfair advantage. However, check it out. I think they just started season 2, so they've got plenty for you to watch. Go check it out at theretrorumble.com. Of course, if you're watching the show in the RGR Plus TV HTML5 player, you're already looking at it. All right, gang, that's going to wrap it up for this month's Bits and Bytes. Remember, almost all of the show's Bits and Bytes comments and sources come right from you, our listeners. So go ahead, go to retrogamingradio.com and submit your information there, or email us at bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com, and you might get your story read right here on the air. This month we're going to take a look at a brand new retake on a very old classic game, Choplifter HD from NXile Entertainment. Let's talk about Choplifter, for those of you who may not be familiar with it. Choplifter came out in 1982. That's a long time ago, right? For those of you who need help doing the math, that's a 30-year-old game. 30 years old. It came out originally on the Apple II platform, and it was immediately ported to every other platform on the planet, I swear to God. Commodore 64, Atari 5200, 7800, 8-bit computers, ColecoVision, MSX, NES, PC-88, Sega Master System, TI-99-4A, VIC-20, a sequel, Choplifter 2, appeared on the Game Boy. Choplifter 3 appeared on the SNES. This game has seen a lot of play, folks, and good for good reason, right? The game is awesome. We're going to get to more about the game in just a minute. But before we get on to that, I wanted to talk a little bit about the publisher of the game, which is Broderbund. Broderbund was formed in 1980. And by a couple of guys. One guy was a lawyer, I think. The other guy was an artist, I believe, right? Started by two guys, and they started off with a handful of these types of games. The Load Runners, the Choplifters, of course. They're also responsible for the Where in the World and Where is Carmen Sandiego series. They also had tons of productivity software, too, that was huge back in the old days, such as the Print Shop and Banner Maker, Card Makers. All this sort of thing. They were a very well-rounded shop, and they did very well. In 1984, Broderbund took over Synapse Software. If that name sounds familiar to you, Synapse put out some fantastic games, such as one of my favorites, which is Ford Apocalypse, Seamus, and a handful of other fantastic games that came out. They took them over in 1984. Here's an interesting little bit of trivia for you. For those of you who thought Ford Apocalypse felt a lot like Choplifter, and you said to yourself, well, it's not Broderbund, so it can't have been influenced by that, you're actually right. Choplifter and Ford Apocalypse, neither one of them are written by the same people, nor were Synapse and Broderbund merged at that point. But I find it interesting, though, that a game like Ford Apocalypse made by Synapse Software, ended up getting acquired by a company that had a game that was very, very similar to Fort Apocalypse. That was kind of an interesting deal. In my research, I found that. Also, Broderbund was owned by Mattel at one point, which is probably how they got their game on the ColecoVision. And they were bought out before then by some place called the Learning Company, which is very interested in things like the Carmen Sandiego and the print shop and things like that. So Broderbund changed hands a little bit. They were absorbed into the Learning Company, owned by Mattel for a while, and then eventually they now are owned by Ubisoft, oddly enough. So all of the Broderbund properties ended up in Ubisoft inside their corporate holdings, if you will. Now, let's talk about Choplifter. Choplifter was a great game. It was a it's a side-scrolling shooter game where you pilot a helicopter that can shoot bullets out of the front, as well as you can rotate the chopper sideways so you have a front view of the chopper. And when you're in that mode, you can drop bombs on the ground. Your goal was to fly from your helipad liftoff, go and find the refugees or the people you're supposed to be rescuing, find them, land the chopper, let the people get on board the chopper, take off, fly them back to the helipad. Now, that sounds pretty easy. Unfortunately, there were a couple of little tiny game parameters you had to work around. First, the chopper would only hold so many people. So once you loaded up the chopper, you had to return to the helipad to drop them off before you could go get the other ones. Some of them were locked up in bunkers. You had to blow the bunkers up, let the people out, and then drop down, pick the people up, and wash, rinse, and repeat, right? Of course, after that, you had a couple other little interesting little things, like tanks on the ground, enemy choppers in the air. So there were plenty of things to keep you busy. In the meantime, you're trying to pick these guys up. Now, you could kill them. You could land on the poor guys and kill them. You could accidentally shoot them or drop bombs on them to kill them. And, of course, the enemy was always looking to kill your guys, too. So the game was actually a very frantic game, very, very much an arcade-style game with a little bit of strategy thrown in. Choplifter was a great title, still is a great title. I've never played the Game Boy version or the SNES version, so I'm not sure how that might actually compare to the most recent entry, which is Choplifter HD. Now, Choplifter HD is available on Windows via the Steam network, Xbox Live, and the PlayStation Network. They all have it. They're all $10 across the board, so you get to choose where you want to purchase it at. There is downloadable content available, add-on choppers, missions, that sort of thing, and both free and paid DLC is available. And you can get a demo on the consoles. You can't get a demo on Windows, unfortunately. But if you have an Xbox or a PS3, of course, you can go and get that demo. Now, the HD version, as you may have suspected, has considerably better graphics than the original one. In fact, it does a lot of really neat things, such as parallax scrolling, lots of background things going on, right? In Choplifter, the original game, you didn't have a lot going on in the background and on the ground. It was pretty much tied up to the mission and some very basic graphics. The mechanics are very similar here. This game is very much similar to the original Choplifter. The overall goal, in the end, is to rescue people with your chopper by landing, picking them up, and taking them back to the helipad to rescue them. The basic concept is exactly the same. Now, I've been a long proponent of modern remakes as long as they're not going to mess with the original game. Now, I also am a proponent that when you do make a remake or a rehash of a classic game, you include the classic game too, which is not included here. I'm a big believer in understanding historical background of your video games. A lot of people don't care. I do. Now, how does the game differ, right? Aside from all the great graphics and all of the music and the sound effects, all of the upgraded media elements that you would just assume would happen taking a 1982 game and putting it out in 2012. So you get all of that, of course, but how does it differ? Well, you have guns and rockets, just like you used to do, except for now you actually have an aiming mechanism, right? In the original game, you kind of fought the chopper, right? Because as you moved right and left, the chopper tilted at an angle based on how much you moved. You couldn't really put the chopper at a 45-degree angle and hold it there in the original game. And you can't hear either. But to compensate for that, to give you some form of accuracy, they added a laser targeting system that you work with the other thumb control, the other analog stick, on the Xbox controller. I played the Windows version, by the way, but I have a wireless Xbox controller adapter. So the game is already tuned in and dialed in for Xbox controller use. So why not take advantage of that while you've got it? It's a system that you would think that would deviate too much from the original, but it really doesn't. It really just, it adds a precision to the original concept, which I think is okay. Next off, there's a difference between foreground and background. Now, that's really, really not different than the original game, and let me explain why. In the original game, you had air enemies like other rogue choppers, right, bad guy choppers. You couldn't kill them with bombs. You had to use guns, which means you were pointed, you know, either right or left. In order to kill the tanks on the ground, you had to rotate your chopper 90 degrees, so you're looking at the front of the chopper, and drop bombs. You couldn't kill them by strafing them with guns. They took the same process and applied it here. There are some enemies on the ground that actually appear in the quote-unquote foreground. There are some enemies you can kill by strafing, and there are some enemies you have to go into that turned chopper mode, which works very similar to the way it did in the old 8-bit days. Using the right and left bumper on the Xbox controller, you then rotate the chopper 90 degrees. So again, you're looking at the front versus the side. So it, like I said, it's very, very similar. And they'll take you through tutorials on teaching you how to do that. It seems a lot harder. For some reason, it seems more complicated than the original game. But in the end, it ends up being exactly like the original game. You do still pick people up, this is true. However, you're not just limited to soldiers that are, you know, crawling out of bunkers. You'll also have TV reporters and other types of people that you can pick up. Most of them are bonuses or hidden objectives. I'm going to get to more of that in a minute. There are also gas stations or gas pads that you can land on to extend yourself. I think in the original Choplifter there was too. I remember in later things, I think you had to go back and get fuel. But yeah, there are gas locations that you'll have to stop, refuel, and go back to your mission. Tons of hidden objectives. Now, of course, you have an objective system. You're supposed to go out and rescue the guys. That's the objective. But how you do it, how proficiently you do it, how much time you use to do it, how many friendly people you accidentally kill in the meantime, all of these things end up with a star system at the end of each one. In other words, if you rescue everybody, then it fills up to 3 stars. If you pick up the hidden, there's, you know, the reporter guy that was also hidden on the level. If you got him and brought him back, that filled up another star. If you killed 5 chickens with your rotor blades, right, that's one of the little hidden objectives of the game. You killed 5 chickens, then that would fill it up to 4 stars, right? And if you accidentally killed somebody, then they would start taking points away, and that reduces your star count. So you finish up each level, providing you meet the main objective, with a certain number of stars. And of course, you know, that's sort of where the replay value is going back and getting all of those stars. So anyway, that's the basic crux of the game. There's lots of unlockables. There's the level system goes, it seems weird because we don't really think of there being as unlockable levels in classic games, but there really were, right? You can't go on to level 2 until you finish level 1, right? So technically, in order to unlock level 2, you have to finish level 1. We tend to forget that that's essentially how classic gaming worked. It wasn't like on Robotron, you could just jump right to the brain level. You had to play the first 4 levels first, or 3 levels. Been a while since I played Robotron. Shame on me. But you get the idea. So the better you do, of course, you'll also unlock other things, different types of better weaponry. You'll unlock better choppers. All that sort of thing. So, again, the beauty of this game, what makes this game work, is the fact that it's still Choplifter. If you were to take all the fancy graphics and sound effects out of the game and put it with primitives, beeps and boops, and, you know, wireframes or primitive polygons, this would still be a fun game. Now, what pushes it over the top is the fact that they've added humor to it. They've added a presence that is more comfortable on a more modern-day console. But in the end, you're going to be able to pick it up and play it very easily, I think. I had no trouble getting into the mechanics of the game because I played a lot of Choplifter. Now, I'm not sure if game players that are not familiar with Choplifter would have that ease of accessibility. So that's why I'm recommending that you pick up Choplifter HD. I think that you'll find the game is so similar in play and adds so many more extras without ruining the essence of the gameplay. It's really a good testament to the way a modern remake should be. You don't take a game, totally change it around, take it from a side-scrolling, space shooter and turn it into a first-person space marine game and call it the same thing, right? That's name-whoring. This game does not name-whore. This game feels like Choplifter. When you play it, you'll think you're playing Choplifter. Now, it looks great. It sounds great. It's got lots of extras. But in the end, you're still playing Choplifter, and that's really the way that these sort of games should be. So, Choplifter HD has Retro Gaming Radio's seal of approval as a good modern remake of a fantastic classic game. Next up, we're going to talk about Another World. You may know this game is Out of This World, as it was originally produced on the Amiga. Another World recently celebrated its 20th anniversary, and as such, the game was ported to smartphones and tablets, namely iOS and Android. Out of This World has a rich history, folks. The company that put it together, Delphine, is another company, much like Broderbund, that has a historical past behind it. And a lot of you may know some of their stuff. But first off, let's talk about Out of This World. Out of This World is the U.S. title. It was called Another World everywhere else. The reason it was not called Out of This World in the U.S. was because there was a daytime serial, a quote-unquote soap opera, named Another World. They wanted to avoid any sort of confusion with that property. So in the U.S., it was Out of This World. I liked Another World myself, and that's the version that I actually played on the Amiga. I had the import. Now, much like Choplifter, we talked about also on the show, Another World or Out of This World has been ported to every platform on the planet. Pretty much anything above and beyond a 16-bit platform, right? Inclusive. That means you've seen this game on Amiga, Apple IIgs, Atari ST, you've seen it for DOS, Sega Genesis, the Macintosh, Super Nintendo, 3DO, Symbian. Symbian has a port of it, Windows 3.1. I mean, this thing's been around a long time, and it's been ported to a lot of stuff. So the game definitely made its round. It started off in 1991, by the way, as an Amiga title. It was created on an Amiga 500 with immediate plans to port it to the 16-bit computers of the day, namely the Atari ST and the Apple IIgs. But, of course, it's made its move around. Now, why was the Amiga chosen to be used? Well, namely, because the creator, the original programmer, Eric Chahi, I can only guess on some of these people's names, Eric Chahi, or Chahi, was the original creator, and he saw the value of being able to use the rotoscoping capabilities of an Amiga using a Genlock. So using his own body as a model, much like Jordan Mechner did for his games, using that rotoscoping, he managed to create very lifelike-looking, essentially fairly primitive polygon-type characters, which became very, very, what's the word I'm looking for? It was a very very distinct look for Another World. Delphine Software, by the way, was also responsible for a couple of other games like the Motor Racer series, which a lot of people played, Cruise for a Corpse, a handful of other titles as well, but those are the ones you'd probably recognize. And some of the other interesting little aspects of the game I noticed when I was doing my research was during the game you'll see a lot of unusual methodologies for moving from level to level, namely things like elevators and lifts. And this apparently was because the animation of walking people up and down stairs was very complicated to do. It was easier to put them on a lift or an elevator and have them stand still while you moved the world around them. So if you ever wondered why you never saw stairs, that's pretty much why. So there you go. So let's talk about another world, the game. The game itself is, well, very much another world. You're a particle physicist at the beginning of the game. Very interesting intro. It's probably running in the background right now if you're watching the RGR Plus TV feed. Alex, I'm sure, put that in there. Anyway, so the intro of the game has you driving up to the office in your Ferrari, and you go in. It's very cinematic. It's very theatrical. Even though we're losing, you know, low count polygons, they move very fluid. There's a music and an ambiance that immediately sucks you into this game. You go into your office and you start running some particle acceleration type experiments. And thanks to a lightning storm, your experiment goes horribly wrong. You're pulled out of your current existence and you're put into, get this, another world. The world you appear in is very hostile. In fact, it's ran by some very big-ass, scary aliens, and they don't have a lot of sympathy for you. So in the first part of the game, you're going to get the hang of the mechanics. You're going to meet some very scary creatures. It's a very unforgiving game. You have infinite lives, but every time you die, you have to restart the level. You have to go back to the last unspoken checkpoint, which can be very, very frustrating. But the game starts you off very simple, running, jumping, kicking to kick some of the primitive creatures of the other world. Eventually, you'll end up with a gun that serves multiple purposes, shooting and defense. You'll puzzle solve. You'll try to find your way through essentially labyrinths of piping at one point. You'll have to roll through this piping until you find your way out. Steam blows and burns your ass alive if you take the wrong turn. So there's a plethora of different things. There's a little bit of action. There's a little bit of shooting, a little bit of trouble or problem solving. And again, it always holds the cinematic feel. The cinematic cutscenes are done with the same engine that runs the game. Rather common these days, but back in those days it was not. And this, of course, was before, you know, full motion video cutscenes became all the rage. So this kind of fell somewhere in between. And it looks fantastic. So let's talk about the version that I'm reviewing today is the Android version. I'm assuming the iOS version is very similar. It comes in two different flavors, both high and low resolution graphics. Now, this doesn't mean like SD and HD and Retina versions. I mean, this means that you can play the game in its original lower polygon count, or you can toggle the game into a higher res where they soften the edges, they smooth things out. Either way, you're going to get a very similar experience to the original. When I say high res, it doesn't mean it changes from a stick figure to a full-blown bump-mapped, light-shaded guy. I'm talking about smoothing some edges off and, you know, taking some of the jaggies out. That's all the high res part means. It's been fully re-enhanced audibly. So the music's been redone. The sound effects have been redone. In most cases, that's good. The sound effects have a higher fidelity to them. Although on the Amiga version, the developer, the original programmer said that there was a considerable amount of breadth in the audio on the Amiga that didn't really translate so well to the other computers. This has a full-blown opportunity to take advantage of that that audio fidelity that we have available to us today, even on Android devices, even on iOS phones. These devices have a much better high fidelity sound than you could have gotten from an Amiga, you know, plugged into a, you know, couple of cheap speakers, right? So they make use of that. Unfortunately, the intro to me, while they didn't really mess with the visual aspect of it, the audio doesn't have the urgency and the sound and the engulfing nature of the original to me. A lot of people wouldn't know, but we used to boot that game up like every week at a users group meeting just to watch the intro. I mean, that was a regular part of the deal. There was state-of-the-art, nine fingers, and then somebody throw in frickin' Another World because we want to watch the intro again. So I've seen it a lot. Most people probably wouldn't even notice the difference. Now, how do you control this game? Well, this is a joystick game, folks. So if you're planning on playing this on the touchscreen, the game's already a hard game anyway. All right. The game is difficult. It's very unforgiving. You know, one wrong move and you're dead. It's just that simple. I mean, it's not something that you can say, okay, well, you know, the enemies have a little less health, so we're going to let you tune that down a little bit. The game is hard. It's hard if you've got a joystick. All right. So they're trying to do some weird remake of the touch controls, and I'm just going to tell you, just pass on that. I mean, I'm sure they worked hard to try to create something that was different and usable on a touchscreen, but I'm telling you, classic games do not belong with touchscreen controls. It's just that simple, folks. Now, there's another option where you can turn on a standard virtual D-pad button scenario, which is no better, because we all know that D-pad gaming totally sucks. Virtual D-pad gaming sucks. So, nicely enough, through the use of Bluetooth controllers, you can actually, not through the game, but through USB Joy or other Android-type-based controls like the iCade or the Z-Mote or whatever, there's plenty of Bluetooth controllers out there that you can get this sort of support. It's Xperia Play ready, right? So if you've got an Xperia phone that has built-in controls, it's already ready to play that way. These are the ways that I recommend you play this game, or you're going to be extremely disappointed. It's hard to play this game when you do have real controls, let alone trying to fight on-screen, touch-screen type controls. What really makes, I think, this game interesting is the variance of types of games that are in here. You've got puzzle solving, you've got action, you've got a multitude of different gameplay type elements, but they're seamlessly put together. You know, there have been games in the past where you start from a flying game, but then you end up on the ground, but then you end up in a third person. And these things don't typically tend to change over so smoothly. Now, you're always going to have the same perspective in this game, but what you're doing in the game, outrunning a monster, right, that's very action-oriented, versus rolling around in tubes, not so action-oriented, right? They shift the type of game around constantly throughout the game, so you're doing different things. You don't feel like you're stymied into one type of a game, but they do it so seamlessly that they change that scope without you really knowing it. So that's really, really neat. The developers were very helpful. The 1.0 version that came out had some Bluetooth control issues. They had made it Xperia playable, which is great because most games that are Xperia controllable, I can simply map my Wii Remote via USB Joy. I can map myself to Xperia controls and I can play. Unfortunately, there was a problem and it would not work properly. The developers jumped on it very quickly. Within 24 hours, I had a working version. So it's always nice to see developers that give a rat's ass about their product and about their people. So that gets lots of bonus points from me. So how does Another World, Another World's Another World, and the version that you're going to play is the exact same version you played before. You know, it's the same game, and that's not a bad thing. A lot of people never finished Another World. A lot of people were like me. They booted up the intro, they played three or four levels of it, and they were done, right? That's it. We're done. Now you get a chance to finish it. You get a chance to play it on a machine. Maybe you got in your pocket. Maybe you've dragged along with you to read an ebook on, right? Now you can play Another World too. Again, Another World is a perfect example of enhancing the graphics and the sound of the game while leaving the original game the hell alone, right? The game was great as it was. You don't need to second guess Eric Chahi or Chahi because he knew what he was doing. That's why the game was so great. So let's not mess with the game. Let's give the game to a new technology. We'll do a little bit of enhancement, right? We'll just nudge it up a decade or two. But let's not mess with the game. And Another World on Android is a perfect example. Again, much like Choplifter, which is another reason why I did these two at the same time on the same show, was to show that there are modern remakes out there that do properly take into consideration the original, that handle the original material respectfully, properly, while still giving the more modern generation what they need to appreciate the game as well, the better graphics, better sound. That's all you really need to do, folks. These games are legends because they were great games. They weren't legends because They, you know, they used a megabyte, you know, a gigabyte of texture memory. You know, there's a reason these games were great, and you know, there's a reason why they were so great. And this is a great example, highly recommended, Retro Gaming Radio seal of approval for modern remakes that respect the original game. That's Another World. You can get it at the Google Play Android Market. I'm assuming you can get it on iTunes or however Apple people get their stuff. And of course, that's pretty much it, actually. So I definitely recommend it. Pick up Another World. You will not be disappointed. Support these guys. Support these guys. These guys also did an R-Type remake, too, which originally I don't believe used physical controls. Imagine playing R-Type with a touchscreen, okay? But they did. They added the Z-Mote control and the Xperia Play. So now they also have R-Type. So if you're really looking for a good side-scroller, same people who made Another World, .mu, by the way, is the name of the company, .mu makes both of those. So check it out. Get yourself Another World. You will not be disappointed. Also this month I want to talk about a new version of MAME for Android. I don't remember if it's out for iOS or not. So I'll have to double check on that when I get back to you. Android, as I've previously looked at on another show, is your standard portable version of MAME. Now, MAME's been ported to a number of different portable devices, the GP2X, the PlayStation Portable, but they've always been based on the infamous 0.37 build of MAME. And the reason being is that after 0.37 of MAME, the developers really did an overhaul on the insides, meaning in order to emulate newer games and slightly newer games faster, they needed to go in and overhaul the cores, rewrite some of the cores, and they did a whole bunch of things after 0.37, things that are important to, you know, not just people who want to play, you know, Daytona USA, but people who want to play Donkey Kong, right? Donkey Kong sounds were borked in 0.37. You had to use sound samples. Star Trek, even with samples, Star Trek had borked sound. Punch-Out. Punch-Out had horrible sound in 0.37, but you put up with it because that's what you had, right? So after 0.37, a lot of things got fixed. They added PROM support to fix some colors and some graphics on a bunch of games. They expanded from 2,500-ish games up to 8,000 games after that. So the grail of MAME has always been on portables, 0.37, on PCs and higher-end devices. You could go all the way up to whatever the current one is, the modern one. Well, the developer of MAME for Droid took it upon himself to say, listen, we got to see what we can do. People are wanting newer games. People are wanting fixes. Let's see if we can get a newer version, 0.134 of MAME, running on Android. So he busted his ass. He created a working project called MAME for Droid Reloaded. And let me tell you, folks, this fixes a lot of stuff. First of all, it adds support for a ton of games, obviously, that the original one didn't have. It fixes the audio in the Nintendo games, right? The Punch-Outs and the Donkey Kong, all that stuff. It fixed the PROMs. It added support for artwork, right? So if you wanted to put a marquee or a bezel art around the game, you can now do that. And this guy, I don't remember his exact name. It's got another one of those names that I'd never be able to pronounce even if I did have it. He's putting a lot of work into this game. He and I have chatted a little bit, talked a little bit about where he's going with the game and with the emulator. And he's got a lot of neat things coming for us, one of which is independent artwork, right? Right now, artwork has to be the same resolution as the game. So if you're playing Donkey Kong and it's 244 by 320 resolution, that's as high a resolution as you can make the artwork, right? So what kind of banner are you going to get in that resolution? Now, he's working on a way of doing independent graphic resolution. So you can have a, you know, 1280 by 200 banner, but still be playing a 244 by 320 game, right? So he's got a lot of neat stuff coming. And believe me, folks, one of the biggest problems with going to the newer versions of MAME is that a lot of the older games run slower, right? That's why a lot of people kept the old cores, the 0.37 version, in addition to the latest version, because in a lot of cases, the older versions had faster cores for the older games. Well, fortunately, both these versions are free, so you can keep both MAME for Droid and MAME for Droid Reloaded on the same system at the same time. And unfortunately, they do use different ROM sets, so you're not going to be able to reuse your ROMs. But again, that's by design, and that's not a bad thing. So, typically speaking, I use MAME for Droid, the original one, for any game that I can. And I only use the games for MAME for Droid Reloaded that either don't run on MAME for Droid or run proper like Star Trek or the Nintendo games. That way, I get the best of both worlds. So anyway, I wanted to bring you up to date on that. I thought that was an important thing. So MAME for Droid Reloaded, pick it up, try it out. I think you will absolutely love it. Some very interesting games that were not playable on 0.37, especially if you got a tablet or something of high resolution. Check out some of the Taito games like Ninja Warriors, Darius, Warrior Blade. These were arcade games that had three screens melded together that formed one giant long screen. They're unusual games, and some of them are actually pretty cool. So check those out as well. Anyway, MAME for Droid Reloaded. Check it out. Get it. MAME, you're going to love having access to all of those games, of course, that you legally own ROM boards for, of course, because we don't condone piracy. So those games that you actually own that you'll want to play on the tablet on the big screen, I think you're going to absolutely love MAME for Droid Reloaded. We love it. Well, folks, that's going to wrap up the March 2012 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Hope you enjoyed the show. Be sure to check out our various other endeavors. Go to Shoutcast.com and pick up the Retro Gaming Radio Plus Shoutcast stream on almost any device, including web browsers and smartphones. You can listen to classic Retro Gaming Radio 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Also, don't forget the show is available in the RGR Plus TV format, which is a digital media interactive experience you can experience right on your HTML5 browser. Listen to the show while getting the links and videos delivered right to you while you sit back and enjoy. Also, for those of you who are looking to order the back editions of the Retro Gaming Radio Classic DVDs, the order form is back online and ready to take your order right now. We have years 1 through 7 available, so check that out as well. And finally, if you're interested in participating in a future live event, which we're going to do more of, then go to Google+, sign in, and circle up Retro Gaming Radio Live. Circle up the Retro Gaming Radio Live page. We'll add you to our list of loyal, devoted fans. And the next time we run a Retro Gaming Radio Live event, you will already have a seat in the front row. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio saying, until next time, keep it retro.